Welcome to the Open UK's Summer of Security series. I'm your host, Matt Yakovit, Head of Open Source Strategy at Percona. We hope you'll join us over the next 6 weeks as we explore all the security topics in the open source space. Stay tuned for our next episode. Hello, everybody. Welcome to a special podcast for the Open UK. We are part of their Summer of Security. And so I'm going to be your host. I'm the Head of Open Source Strategy at Percona, Matt Yakovit. And we are going to be doing a series of talks with security experts around the UK. And today we're talking with Terence Eden. Terence, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thanks, Matt.
Now, Terence, you work for the UK government.
I do, yes. I'm part of Securing Government Services, which is part of the Central Digital and Data Office, which is part of Cabinet Office. There's lots of acronyms in my job.
There seems to be a lot of acronyms in your job. So for those of you know who aren't, you know, those of you who are listening who aren't from the UK, or maybe you are, maybe tell people a little bit about what the CDDO does.
So one of the missions of CDDO is to make technology better inside of government. So we have a department which is called GDS, Government Digital Service, which does a fantastic job with user-facing technology. So if you ever go to gov.uk and you need to fill in a form or find some information, they're the people that help you do that. But what do you do for people who are inside government? How do you make technology better for them? And that's what Central Digital and Data Office is doing. And as part of my job in securing government services, we look at securing government services, because lots of people want to try and disrupt what the UK does, and we try to make things safer and more secure.
So you're working on the external as well as the internal.
Yeah, so okay. I'm looking at the security of the .gov.uk domain name. So every government department which has a domain name, every town council or parish council which has a .gov.uk domain name, they've all got wildly different needs, but they all need to be secured, because that's where people go to find out reliable information.
Yeah, and I mean, you can't shake a fist nowadays without seeing people who have had their data breached, you know, their data spilled on, you know, to the internet. So people who are using, you know, any sort of government services or any services they need on a regular basis are expecting some semblance of security, because they don't want that data to be leaked all over the place.
Absolutely. And, you know, something like billions of transactions every year go through gov.uk. And that can be as simple as, I want to find out when my bins are going to be collected. Or it might be as complicated as, I need to fill in my tax return and, you know, work out what I need to pay. And everything in between. And so it's just, you know, if these services were to become unavailable, let's say there was a cyber attack and your local council website went offline. Well, okay, that's pretty bad. You wouldn't be able to see when your bins are going to be collected, or maybe contact your local councillors. And then it sort of gets worse and worse, sort of the bigger the department you go. So we've got a real vested interest in making sure that all of those services stay online and are stable.
So I'm guessing that as a young child, you didn't dream of this particular job. So how did you come into the technology space, and what kind of led you to where you are today?
So it's how I got here today is, I think it's a funny story. So I was, many years ago, I was messing around on the internet, and I discovered a government website which someone had hacked, and they were using it to sell little blue pills. And, you know, which I don't think that government website was meant to be doing. And I contacted the team in Government Digital Service and went, you know, there's some government websites which, I don't know, they don't look like they're doing so good. And they went, oh, thank you for letting us know, and very quickly fixed them. And so since then, I've always had an interest in security. And I think one of the important things is that we do security in the open. There's no point, you know, if I hadn't found a way to contact that government department to say, hang on, I think there's a problem here, then what would have happened? They wouldn't have known that their site had been hacked, or, you know, data had been lost, whatever had happened. So as I sort of moved through my career, one of the things I've been doing is trying to open up bits of government, make it easier for people to contact government, and also be a bit more open about what we're doing. So that the next time someone like me finds a flaw or finds a vulnerability, they don't go, ha ha ha, I'm going to sell this to the highest bidder. They're going to go, oh, actually, it's really easy to contact the government, get them to fix it. They'll say thank you. And then, you know, the state will be a bit more secure for everyone.
So it's really about increasing access, increasing visibility, bringing more eyeballs to the problem that's the problem sets that are out there.
Yeah, I mean, that's that famous open source saying, isn't it? That many eyes make all bugs shallow. We have millions and millions of people every day using our services. And inevitably, you know, there is going to be a problem somewhere. And if it's a security problem, we want to be alerted as soon as possible so that we can go and fix it so it doesn't cause more problems. And we don't do that by being, you know, our job is so secure, no one must contact us. No, completely the opposite. If you find a problem, we want to know as soon as possible. And then we can either email the person responsible to fix it ourselves, or, you know, publish blog posts saying, you know, how we've made a fix, what we've done.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that, you know, it's interesting from an open source perspective. You know, you mentioned open source a little bit. That's classically been something that we've looked at in the open source space to try and solve is how do we allow more people to have access to our software to make it better? So how did you get involved in open source?
Oh, wow. I mean, I remember being at university like 100 years ago. I don't think the words open source were really a thing there. But, you know, my friends and I shared the code that we'd written, and then we were on Usenet and people were posting code samples and things like that. And from there, I just remember it sort of growing and growing. And, you know, I bought this weird thing on floppy disk called Linux. I think it was Red Hat Linux or something like that. And I destroyed my parents' computer trying to install it. It was fine.
How many floppy disks was it?
You know what? I think it was only about five, you know,
really?
that long ago. Oh, wow. But since then, I've just been fascinated with this idea that I can see what the computer's doing. And if the computer isn't doing something that I want it to do, I can go in there and fix it, or I can ask someone how to fix it. And, you know, with closed source stuff, you can't do that. And to sort of bring it back to what I'm doing now, so much of people's interaction with government happens via software. Why shouldn't they be able to see what that software is doing, the decisions it's making, you know, why the slider doesn't go all the way to the end, why this box, you know, it's not very fashionable, I think, sometimes to talk about morals, but I think there is a moral imperative that if we are spending the public's money, that should result in public code and people should be able to see it. They might not always understand it, but some people will, and some people will be able to explain what's going on, and some people will dive in and give us bug reports, which is great. We love that because that's someone else who's found a problem, we can fix it, and occasionally people are skilled enough that they can send us pull requests, and that's fantastic. If someone is so motivated that, you know, how many times have you sort of been interacting with the service and think, this is rubbish, why can't the box do this? Why is the color scheme all wrong? Why? Normally, you can't do anything, but because most government services are open source, you can go in and fix it. Now, we're not going to accept every single pull request that we get, but at least it tells us someone's looking at our code. This fix, you know, very, you know, more often than not, we take a look at a bug report and a pull request and go, huh, yeah, all right, this is something that we can either, if not this exact thing, then something like it, and we can begin to fix things.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an interesting concept, and I've been in the open source space for a long time, but those who are concerned about this often say, by making this open, doesn't this leave security open and invite hackers or other folks?
Hackers and spies and everything.
And spies and yes, and yes.
It's rubbish. No, it's not true. I mean, the thing is that when you go onto GitHub, other open source platforms are available. But, you know, when you go into GitHub, there's GCHQ are on there, which is part of our security services. The National Crime Agency are on there putting out code. The defense and science laboratories are out there putting out code. Because what we know is that closed source, it turns out, no more secure than open source, no less secure than open source. They're basically, it doesn't really make a huge amount of difference. With the National Cybersecurity Center, the NCSE, have done a whole bunch of research on this, and it really doesn't make a huge amount of difference. Because if you've if you are skilled enough to get the compiled code of something, you're probably skilled enough to decompile it and start looking through for bugs that way. So, you know, having the software, having the source code closed really isn't a huge impediment to anyone who's dedicated enough to want to attack things. And the benefits that we get of working in the open means that we're aware people are looking over our shoulder. So when we're writing, we're writing with half a mind on that. But also other people can look at it, and people run analysis on our code all the time. And sometimes they come and say, oh, think, you know, whether it's you've missed a semicolon or a buffer overflow over there, whatever it is, they'll be able to find it and report it to us. Whereas if it was closed source, no, you know, be harder to analyze from a security research point of view. So the sort of considered opinion we've come to is, if there is something so super duper secure that, you know, absolutely no one must be able to look at it, you know, not even the people working on it, fine, all right, let's keep that closed. But the majority of our stuff just makes sense for it to be open.
So, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I think that having the more eyeballs on things helps. I think having more people who are willing to, you know, take a look and help with bug fixes or point out problems, or even, you know, find a problem that might not be a security issue, but an issue that this just doesn't work right.
Yeah.
And I want it to work better. I think those can all benefit everyone.
We want to work together. We are not, you know, when I don't want to be in a position where I tell people what to do. I want to work with my team. And I consider my team to be every single civil servant who wants to be involved in the domain name space. And really, anyone who goes into a web browser or an email thing and types something, 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 .gov.uk, they're part of my team. And, you know, I want to work with them. If something's not working for a user, and whether that user is a citizen trying to do something, a tourist trying to find something, or a council trying to get their website set up, if those users aren't happy, you know, I want to work with them as a team.
Now, you know, we talk a lot about open source, but one of the other things that you're involved in is open standards. What's the difference for those who don't know?
So an open standard is, the way we try to, usually try to explain this is, it's the way that two computers communicate with each other. So if I send you an image and it's in a format like JPEG, you will be able to decode, decrypt that, display it on your screen, nice and happy. But what if I've created my own image format, you know, Terence's magic image format, the TMIF, and I send that to you, you're going to go, well, how am I supposed to open this? And I say, oh, that's fine. I'll sell you a license for it for, you know, 500 quid. All of a sudden, we've now got a closed standard and you're not able to interact with it. And this is what we see. We want every single computer in government to be able to talk to each other without needing to pay a gatekeeper in the middle, a per use fee, a license fee, or something like that. And open standards means that, you know, we don't have to reinvent the wheel each time. If you look at our plain old boring text, you know, we do everything when we're doing plain text, we use Unicode. We haven't invented the UK government text format, because, you know, even if we did, how would we get it adopted everywhere? How would we exchange documents around the world? So this is why we sort of look at open standards and coming into security when we're looking at things like protecting against spam. We use SPF, Sender Policy Framework, and DMARC, which I can't remember what stands for, but I'm sure someone in the comment section will.
Yeah.
And these are all open standards which we can take and go, you know what, everyone around the world is using this. We do not need a special UK government version of this. We will use the same standards as everyone else, which makes it easy for us to recruit people, because we're not saying, hey, you need 5 years experience of this thing that only the government uses. No, you need 5 years experience of this thing that everyone uses. Oh, great. That's nice and easy to recruit for. When we have software which interacts with our services, we can just say it uses the standard. Great. We can buy software from anyone now. And that's why we sort of use open standards.
So does this take away choices, though? Like if you know, there are other people who want to engage with the government or, you know, engage in different businesses, but they want to use different standards, or they have different things that they rely on or prefer?
Yeah. So that's an interesting challenge. I mean, I think there's a great XKCD cartoon about, you know, the great thing about standards, there being so many to choose from, and, you know, let's create another one and there's slightly more standards. What we say is that when the government creates stuff, it must be in an open standard so that anyone can read it. So a good example is if we're creating spreadsheets or tabular data, we put that out as CSV, so comma separated values. Literally every piece of spreadsheet software on the planet can read that, whether you're doing data science in NumPy or whether you're using Microsoft Excel, you'll be able to read the CSV. We can also put documents out in Excel format or open document spreadsheet or, you know, some other weird format. But what we're saying is when we produce something, it has to be readable by the world. We can't ever be in a position to say, if you want to read a government document, you've got to pay that corporation over there 100 quid for a license to use software. That, you know, that's not what being a sort of an open friendly government department is all about.
Okay. Yeah. And I mean, you know, along with that, you know, open standards, you know, it brings along the ability to collaborate more across different departments, different organizations, internal, external,
different governments.
Yeah. And so how do you view kind of the collaboration between the government and the outside world, you know, either with these standards or elsewhere?
So one of the great things is we are involved in standards organizations. So I was a representative to the W3C, the Worldwide Web Consortium, where you know, I was a civil servant and I was paid to sort of be there and edit the HTML5 specification and answer questions, but also reflect the views of government into that standards body. And we still have people working in W3C. I was at ICANN, which is the International Corporation for Assigning Names and Numbers. Again, someone in the comment section, please correct me if I'm wrong. And just a whole bunch of different standards organizations where we can say a couple of things. The first is, hey, we're the government and we've got some views on this because we don't want the standards to make it too hard for us to work. But also, you know what, we've got some experience in this, or we have some security concerns about this standard. Will you listen to our suggestions? And the great things about standards organizations is, by and large, they're sort of huge sprawling things where everyone gets to shout and, you know, discuss. There's no one overpowering voice. So we can't go in there and say, this is what we want and you have to give it to us. No, we have to convince people that what we want is going to be in the best interests of all the stakeholders for this standard.
So with that, do you think that there needs to be more maybe rules or regulations around those standards that apply to open source as a whole? Because one of the things that, you know, is a challenge in the open source space, everybody's talking about the security of the supply chain, you know, where things are coming. But you also see that there is a rise in the number of, just the pure number of packages, the number of software and the number of competing things that are starting to pop up in the space, which, you know, can drive confusion. You look at, for instance, I know your favorite Kubernetes. There's 17 different flavors of Kubernetes that you can run. All of them have basically the same thing, but they have slight nuances. And so is this a place where more standardization you think could help? Or do you think this is where the innovation and the issues that could arise from having too many choices might be better than having some standardization?
That's such a pertinent challenge. Now, obviously, I don't create law. I'm in no position to, you know, set the law for how to do this.
Yes, disclaimer. Terrence doesn't set the law here.
For some things, I think internally in an organization, I think it's absolutely fine to say, we use version one of this and nothing else. Or, you know, we use this flavor of Markdown and nothing else. And that's fine for a single organization. But yeah, once you try to talk with the outside world and you go, oh, well, we're using version one. You're using version 1.1. And, you know, things just don't mesh together. It becomes hard. So my personal point of view is that as much as possible, standards should retain backwards compatibility. And that breaking changes, you know, really should be avoided. I think that's one of the sort of Linux kernel ideas, isn't it? That, you know, user space, you know, it should never break user space stuff. And I feel like that with standards as well. I don't think that any of us who sort of work on open source want to be told what to do. And that, you know, it's like herding cats. You know, if we said as an entire open source community, right, from now on, we're going to do it this way, at least three prominent open source people would turn around and go, well, no. I'm going to do it this way. You know, we can't stifle innovation like that. The good ideas are going to bubble up. Some good ideas just aren't going to get any traction, and that's going to be sad. And some bad ideas are going to sort of proliferate until we eventually work out a way around them. I'm looking at you, YAML. I think that for us, we're going to say, this is what we want to do. And when we interface with people, we're going to try and work out how we do that. But as an open source movement as a whole, I think we just have to be so careful not to break the user experience. And that means, you know, no breaking changes, you know, even when you're jumping versions.
So, you know, we've seen a massive rise in the, at least the press around, you know, security issues. We've had security issues for years, let's be honest. They're becoming bigger because we're relying more on digital technology more than ever before. So it impacts more and more people, but we had security issues 10 years ago. We've had security issues 5 years ago, right? We're just seeing it. It's a larger impact. What are you seeing that is driving more security issues nowadays? Like, is there some areas that people are just, they're not following best practices? Is it because there's just so much software we don't understand? I mean, I have my own theories, but I'll let you go first. And
I think for me, the big one that we've seen is, I don't want to say people are the weakest link, because, you know, we're all under a lot of pressure. You know, we're all doing our best under difficult circumstances, you know, around the world. And it's been difficult circumstances for a while now. But there are some things like, you know, people don't update their software. You know, a new bug comes out. We need to update it. Yeah, well, we're busy this week, or we've got a big release, you know, next week. We'll get around to it. And then it never happens. And then game over. Now, there are some cases where, you know, you need to be on a constant patch cycle and, you know, not still running, you know, Windows 3.11 somewhere in a server closet. Giving people space so that they know that, you know, it's all right to pause to update security, I think is something which we still haven't figured out. The other thing is, you know, we look at things like two-factor authentication, multi-factor authentication. It's a pain. You know, I mean, passwords are a pain, and that's why lots of people's password is password. Not you, obviously, and not me.
Hold on, I got to change my luggage password here.
But, you know, and so we've put out great guidance. NCSE has put out great guidance about password policies, and we know that if you tell people every 30 days you've got to change your password, and it's got to contain letters and numbers and symbols and paragraphs and a cat, and you can't reuse any of your 17 previous passwords, and it mustn't have more than two. People can't manage that. And so we put out guidance which says, don't tell people that they must update their passwords every 30 days. You know, if you discover the password's been breached, force them to update it. You know, maybe do an audit and remind people what their passwords are. But, you know, telling people to update their passwords every 30 days just means that all people do is stick the number one at the end of their password. And that's...
No. The second time they change it, it's the number two, yeah. And then number three, and then number four.
Yeah. So we need to get better ways for this sort of authentication and authorization. I think multi-factor authentication plays a part in it, but of course now it means, you know, if you lose your keys or, you know, something like that, are you locked out? So we've got to find ways to make security more humane, I think is where I'd go with that.
Well, I think one of the other things that I've seen that's really driven a lot of security issues, and I'm curious your take on this, is, you know, mentioned, you know, making it easier for people, but we've pushed a lot of really complex technology into the hands of people who didn't have access to it, you know, a few years ago.
Yeah.
So we've lowered the barrier of entry quite a bit. You know, and so when you look at, you know, for instance, you know, I'm in the database space. So you go to a cloud provider, you click a button and it's done.
And it's done with defaults, which leave your entire database open to the entire world.
But I think that there's an assumption, and there's an assumption with a lot of software, that it's good enough by default. And, you know, default password is, it must be good enough. Or whatever those default, you know, configurations, it's good enough. And that good enough mentality leads to a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But I think that as a society, we're more in a rush than ever before. So it's not like, you know, management at companies is saying, slow down. Think about what you're doing. You know, it's okay if you miss your deadlines. It is rush, rush, rush. Go as fast as you can. And so people look for shortcuts. And those shortcuts typically mean that you're going to rely on just that, just good enough, or
it should just work.
It should just work, especially on those technologies you don't really understand.
Yeah.
And that's where they leave those crazy openings. So, so you lower the barrier of entry for folks, and then you find out that maybe they weren't up for the responsibility. So, Spider-Man quote, right? With great power comes great responsibility, right?
So, it's one of the things that we do for government software is talk about secure by design. Security isn't something that, you know, you build the product and then at the end you go, right, now let's add security. Just like you don't build a product and then in the end you go, now let's add accessibility. It has to be there from the beginning. And that's why we publish so much guidance, and we publish it in the open. So anyone can go to gov.uk and, you know, find our secure coding guidance and go to NCSC and find, you know, security guidance there, because we want to make that level of security available everywhere. It is, you're completely right. Too often you download an app and it's just so easy to delete everything or accidentally upload, you know, your entire photos to the entire world. We don't want that. So one of the core tenets of what we do is test with real users. So often, you know, when I speak to companies, they go, oh, we've got personas, you know, we've got Doris who's 37 and likes cheese, and, you know, okay, but that's great if you're building a product, but have you actually tested it with someone who's disabled or distracted or whatever? Will they understand it? And if they don't, there's a real problem. We quite often talk about you know, things like even just being able to read complex sentences can sometimes be a barrier for people. And government has to be for everyone. You can't say, because you can't read English so good, you know, you can't interact with government. We can't have that. So we need to test, you know, the wording and make sure that if there is a big button which says, you know, destroy everything, that there are proper safeguards behind that, so that when someone is going and using it, they can't accidentally do it and, you know, cause themselves real problems.
Yeah, accessibility is a huge deal, right?
Yeah.
And I think that from an accessibility perspective, what you have to look at is there's multiple ways and you can't cover all the potential permutations.
Sure.
Right? When you talk about especially public access software and services, you're really talking about something that has to have a level of accessibility that isn't really baked into almost any other modern application.
You say accessibility is a good idea. I mean, it's not just a good idea; it's the law.
It's a requirement, right?
Yeah. I mean, it, literally in public. Someone in the comments, I know you're doing a lot of work, but please correct me. I think it's the Public Services Accessibility Directive or something like that, which basically says, if you're a government department and you're offering service to the public, it must meet this level of accessibility, which is WCAG 2.1, I think now. And that, you know, sets things like, you know, the minimum level of contrast, the size that fonts have to be, but also, does this work with the screen reader? If you're blind, partially sighted, visually impaired, you know, you might use a screen reader to read out text. And so you can't have just images with no text, you need alt text, all sorts of stuff. And again, the way that we help with this is we publish all of our guidance in the open. We have an open source toolkit so that if someone wants to spin up a new service, there is something which already has accessibility baked in. And the default, as you were saying, the default is it's accessible.
Yeah, and what's interesting is, you know, when people are thinking about, you know, open source software, they often think about contributions. But people might be saying, well, how can I contribute to the government or these projects? I find that accessibility features or, you know, extending what's already out there is often a good first step, because a lot of people might, maybe they are immigrants from a different country. These, you know, their English isn't so great. So they're looking for, you know, translations, and those don't exist. So translations of documentation and software and websites, those are often really good contributions that can extend a open source product's
reach and sort of new markets and stuff like that. Yeah. And getting started, even, you know, if you find a, hopefully there aren't too many accessibility bugs in government websites, but if you do, it's a great way to make a contribution. Even if all you're saying is, hey, I find this text really hard to read, you know, that's feedback which can be used. But the other thing is, it's not just about contributing to open source. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love people contributing to the open source stuff that we put out. What I like even more is when they take it, lift it, shift it, and do something else. So we know that there's a bunch of governments around the world who looked at the early success of GDS and went, well, we'll have some of that. Our code is published as, I think, mostly MIT license. They take it, they spin it up. Congratulations, you've got a brand new accessible government website. We know that people who are starting small projects, non-government related, will go, how am I going to get started? Oh, well, this government template is actually a really good starting point. I'll change the font and the color and, you know, they're not going to have the government logo on it. But it's now, you know, this is why we produce stuff in the open.
It's because, a starting point.
Yeah. It's not like we can sell this. You know, we are not the government is not a private company which sells software. So there is no disadvantage to us for someone to come along and say, oh, that code's really useful. That's a good starting point for me. And off they go. It's fantastic.
Yeah. No, and I think that, you know, the combination of, you know, not only providing the templates and the blueprints for people to learn from, but also enabling them to, you know, contribute back and make the government more efficient and more accessible is just a huge win.
Yeah.
So Terrence, let me kind of close with a couple of questions for you. I like to often ask a few random questions. But I'm curious, you know, when you look out at the current security landscape, what is the one piece of advice that you could offer people that would help them the most? Like, what would be the one thing that you would encourage people to do?
Turn your computers off and go outside. I do actually have a serious point to that, which is, we sometimes think that computer security is the be-all and end-all. And it's really important. And, you know, computer security, you know, it can take down hospitals or shipping containers or anything like that. But we sometimes neglect the fact that there is a world outside of computers, and that, you know, we need to, the last few years have shown anything, we need to be friends with our neighbors. We need to understand how the physical institutions around us work. We need to, you know, physical security is important, you know, locks on your doors as much as making sure your firewall's secure. So I think, yeah, sometimes it's all right to switch off the computer, go outside, look around and see what is it in my local environment that needs attention. Because, you know, don't get me wrong, I stare at my screen all day long and I absolutely love it, but it's good to go outside. It's good to wander around. A, it clears your head, but B, it actually shows you what's going on around you. And that's just so important for your peace of mind, but also, you know, maybe it'll help with your physical security. Maybe having a nice area which is clean, you know, doesn't attract so much vermin, and, you know, that also helps as well. So switch your computers off after you finish listening to this podcast. Switch it off, go outside, see what
you can put it on your headphones.
No technology, just go outside.
Oh, no technology.
See what needs doing, and try and fix the world as best you can.
Fair enough. And what piece of software in the open source space has you really excited that you use it every day? Maybe you're learning about it. It's something that, wow, this is something that I would I'm really getting into and I enjoy.
Well, so obviously our government department doesn't endorse any specific piece, but on a personal level.
Personal level.
I've just switched to Pop OS, which is a Linux distribution, and it's fantastic. I'm running Wayland on like three screens, and it's on an old laptop, but it's as smooth as anything. Pop have done a fantastic job of making a Linux distribution which is user-friendly. And don't get me wrong, I can still open up a terminal and futz around on the command line as much as I want, but it looks nice, it works smoothly, I press a button, everything updates. So as sort of consumer piece of tech, I think Pop OS is fantastic.
Awesome, very good. Well, Terrence, thank you for sitting down with us today. We appreciate chatting with you, and thank you for telling us a little bit about the security in the government space.
It's been great. And I suppose I should give a plug for the stuff that we're doing. If you're interested in government APIs, go to api.gov.uk and you'll find all sorts of open APIs where you can start interacting with government data. And if you find any security bugs with government websites or government domains, if you go to gov.uk/security.txt, you'll find our contact details.
All right. All right, Terrence, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Cheers. Bye.